once I was able to realize that this has absolutely nothing to do with poetry, or from an actor's point of view, nothing to do with the English class. This is to be done. It's to be done. It's, there's a vitality to it. There's an energy to it, a velocity to this language. The immediacy, the action is in the words. So once I was able to get past that and go, oh, I understand now, then it all just came rushing into me. Like this goes back hundreds of thousands of years of a social interaction that goes back historically to the campfire, to reenacting the hunt, to reenacting our relationship to our gods, to nature. I think this is the essential part of our being human.
Hi, and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Jim Elliott.
And I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And today on the program, we have Nicholas Martin Smith, the producing artistic director and founder of The Hudson Warehouse in New York City.
Welcome, Nicholas.
Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, guys. Thank you very much for having me on today. This is very exciting.
Well, we're excited because we know that the Hudson Warehouse is celebrating its 10th anniversary season of offering free Shakespeare at the Soldiers and Sailors Monument in Riverside Park.
That's right. And it's quite a thrill for us.
How did the Hudson Warehouse get its name?
That's interesting. I've always, ironically, lived next to a river in every city I've lived in. And I just decided on the name because I would take a walk down there and hang out by the river. And it just seemed to describe who we were as a company, as far as being a warehouse of skill, talent, craft. So basically came to me on a walk.
In the park. So, Nicholas, what compelled you to produce outdoor theater for free?
My feeling is that theater is an essential part of being human, an essential part of our society, and has been for tens of thousands of years. I don't believe it should be something that should cost people lots of money in order to share in a ritual that is essential to daily life. So I feel that it's a necessary part of our society to contribute free theater.
You mentioned that theater is a necessary part of our daily life. In what sense do you mean that? I'm certain that there are people out there who go through their daily lives and don't encounter theater on a daily basis or aren't aware that they do.
I agree. And I think they should. I believe they're missing something.
I could say that it would boil down to story and telling a story.
Exactly. And it's one step further from actually sitting and telling the story about the hunt with the Macedon to actually getting up and reenacting and somebody throwing, you know, the hide over their shoulders and they're suddenly the Macedon.
Right.
So we have Thag over there and suddenly miming the spear into this other poor guy who's dressed as the Macedon, you know. So I think it all stems from there. And I think those people that you talk about who are wandering around not even realizing that they are missing it are the same people who will wander by in the park in the middle of Act Two of Romeo and Juliet and just stop and spend the rest of the evening watching Romeo and Juliet, never having experienced anything like it before. And they leave radiant. They leave thrilled in a way they never have before.
So is that Hudson Warehouse's mission?
Yes, it is. We do believe it's an essential part of daily life, that creating this theater in an environment that is accessible and also creating these productions that are crafted to be relevant to today, that's set either in our time or in a period of time near to ours, that's a doorway for them. I think it's important to educate. I also think it's important to thrill our audience.
So is it going too far to say that your ideal audience member might be someone who has no idea or intention of attending the theater that day, but just happens to find him or herself in Riverside Park for whatever reason, and here's this play happening?
Those people who we bring in just by the sheer act of them being in the park at that moment, they're the people who are the reward.
Does that idea trickle down into your whole process?
That's one of the exciting things about the Hudson Warehouse and the location is that there are seats that are practically right on the stage.
Exactly right. And it is. It's a three-quarter thrust.
To bridge from that moment in 04 when you were having a walk in the park and you happened upon this found space, which is a three-quarter thrust, to today. How did you make that happen in the early days? How did you go about making that vision a reality?
I met Jim Nicolosi from New York Theater Workshop 15 years ago, and he explained he started out by putting on a show and inviting his friends, and it worked, so they decided to do it again. And when I started the Hudson Warehouse, it was not with the intention of creating this. It was simply to bring a vital theater to the public. People came to see it. So that only encouraged us and let us know we were doing something right.
What were some of the hurdles you had to overcome through the years to continue this forward? Just one or two.
Exactly. The big one is weather. You know, we've had to cancel shows for hurricanes. We've had to cancel shows for the heat index of 115. Mm-hmm. The weather is the biggest obstacle. But there's the obstacle of being persistent. You have to be persistent with basic things like getting the permit. But those are obstacles. The obstacle of the human element. I mean, there are homeless people who live in the park. And one of them lived there for years and was incredibly threatening. We had to deal with him. His name is George, and we got to know him over the years. But, you know, I was very nice and pleasant with him.
And is he still there?
No, I guess I was very, very nice. No, he hasn't been there for about 2 or 3 years. 3 years, I guess, now. So.
And who has helped Hudson Warehouse along the way?
Oh, it was just me as far as putting it together every year. And eventually, I started working with Joe Hamill. He and I ran the company for about 4 years together. And that's when the company really became established. He and I really were consistent about a lot of things. And consistency is very important. You don't want to chew off more than you can eat. Susan came on board, and Susan Lee, who's the assistant artistic director, came on board in 2010. She comes with this experience, and besides just artistic experience, she really brought an element in that we hadn't had before. And that really solidified who we were. At the same time, there have always been these actors who have been with us who are a crew. And this crew would cover all the other bases, costumes, props.
I noticed that you use a core group of players. And how does that shape what you've done? And how is that different than outsourcing your work for every show?
It means that you have this wonderful flow of creative energy and contribution and organization. So that original crew of actors from before has now grown into this company of people who put the time and the energy in and who also work as actors and as directors. Everyone's purpose is focused on the same thing, which is to bring this vital free theater to the public. So everyone's attention's on the same goal.
And so now, at this current point in time, you're doing the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged.
Yes.
King Lear starts in July.
That's right.
And in August, you're doing the Three Musketeers.
Yes, which I'm very excited about. One of the things about the space is that it's a non-traditional theater space, which lends itself to spontaneity that you wouldn't otherwise have in a traditional theatrical environment. For example, you can enter. I've had actors enter from trees, over walls, through bushes, and there's a whole interaction that goes on with the audience there that you don't get in a regular theater, in a normal traditional theater environment. The interaction, the involvement that we have, and we wanted to do something really outside the box for our 10th anniversary. So we decided what else would be better than to do all of Shakespeare's plays. And what is that but the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged? And the play is the epitome of what we do. That as far as the way we involve the audience. A perfect example is the other night on Sunday night's performance. Ian, one of the actors, Ian Harkins, at one point is to bolt into the audience, sit next to one of the audience members and just start doing his ad-lib. And his whole intro is always going to be, I'm going to sit next to this lovely woman or this, you know, this gentleman here. And he goes, I'll sit next to this lovely little baby. And isn't she sweet? And he sat next to this woman, her baby, and she handed the baby to him. Without any prompting, this woman hands this actor her baby, who can't be more than, I don't know, 7 months. And suddenly the baby's face just lights up, and Ian, he just starts cooing to this little baby. And Chris and I can't do anything until that baby leaves his hand. And I look at him, and I
turn him into the football.
I look at Ian, I just go, Ian, put the baby down. July, we're doing Lear. And Lear, I just feel, is one of his most soulful plays. I find it incredibly moving. And just the story is so relevant also to today.
just to return to something you said earlier, I think audience interaction is so important for theater. And when companies or producers or theaters aren't set up to encourage that or don't value that, then they're putting themselves in a position to compete with other media, which don't have that opportunity, like film and television, for audience interaction. But when you make it a part of the show, a part of the fabric of who you are, then there is no competition because you can't get that anywhere else.
You're absolutely right. And that's a very good point, particularly now in the 21st century. You're absolutely right. And again, I go back to this, but it's, I believe, an essential part of being human. And people don't realize what they're missing until they experience it and they feel that thrill. It is its own niche in a way that it never has been before because we haven't been in the situation we are now with social media, with the films and televisions and all those formats that don't permit this.
Yeah, and the give and take between the audience and the players is like nothing else.
Nothing else.
But speaking of humanism, the piece you've chosen to share with us today is one of the most famous humanist speeches in all of the canon. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Jaques' speech from As You Like It. It's interesting what made me think of it. I begin in complete works with the first four lines of this piece. And that made me go back and look at it again. And I realized at this point, this piece speaks more to me now than ever before in my life. And I can remember directing it in 07 in the park and recognizing its value, but not understanding the human element in it fully. I think it's just being at a certain point in my life that I now look back. I have a stretch now to look back on. And I recognize so many elements of this that I didn't before. And I think that's often the case in life. I mean, you know, we get to a certain point, we look back and we sort of find ourselves in a place we've certainly never been before. And how moving that is.
The speech you're referring to, of course, is the famous All the World's a Stage speech from As You Like It, Act 2, Scene 7. That's and you're speaking really to Jaques' mindset as he's delivering the speech.
Exactly. It's about him being in that place in his life where he is looking back and having to cope with his own mortality.
The piece starts midline, and the preceding lines are, "Thou seest we are not all alone unhappy. This wide and universal theater presents more woeful pageants than the scene wherein we play in." So the Duke gives you your theme,
mm-hmm.
and you run with
yeah.
it. I mean, we've heard this speech so many times. One of my first questions was, is it a set piece? But it's not. It's more of an impromptu musing.
Yes. You're right. You're absolutely right. It is. It's spontaneous.
Nicholas Martin Smith, would you set the scene for us? Who is Jaques and who's he speaking to?
Jaques is the melancholy lord who is with...
You can't get away from that word melancholy when you refer to this speech.
I agree. And I kind of get bummed out.
It makes you melancholy.
Well, yes, exactly.
So he's talking to the Duke.
He's talking to the Duke. And the character's arc is trying to find his way through the world.
Would you like to perform it for us?
Absolutely. All the world's a stage. And all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts. His acts being seven ages. At first, the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy, with his satchel and his shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in full round belly with good capon lined, with his eyes severe and beard a formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. Sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big, manly voice turning again toward the childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound, Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you so much, Nicholas.
One of the things that jumps out at me is that the very construction of the poetry, even though you can't speak of this without mentioning melancholy, the construction of the poetry seems to prevent the actor from falling into a melancholic rumination. Why is that?
I believe it's the spontaneousness of it. Also, I think it's the nature of Shakespeare, and as far as the way he wrote, which was in the moment. You know, there's nothing, you know, you don't talk about something having happened or how you felt about something. It's how you feel in the moment. So he can't maintain, you cannot maintain a melancholy feel through all these different elements and different periods and ages of one's life. You know, that youthful lover, that the infant. And I love the phrase, the sighing like furnace when describing a lover. Yeah, there's some wonderful images, but they happen in the moment.
One of the more interesting things about this piece of text is that some of the lines you just said, they all start with a trochee, mewling, sighing, full of jealous, seeking. And it almost does exactly what you're talking about, which is keeps that ball moving forward in the moment.
Yeah.
Another thing which seems to keep the ball moving forward is that although Jaques tells us what he's going to tell us, doesn't he? At the beginning, he says his acts being seven ages. So you know what's going to come.
Right.
And each age that he introduces, instead of introducing the age at the beginning of the line, as you'd expect, he introduces these new ideas right in the middle of the verse, right in the midline, very often at the fourth foot.
That's right.
So I wonder if that is something that you as an actor in the delivery are aware of, or if that operates at an unconscious level.
Okay. I think with experience, it happens at an unconscious level. I think with the experience, it becomes subconscious. But I think for him, there's certainly a conscious choice to do that. Yeah, absolutely.
When you break a text down, do you look for stuff like that? Or are you confident that your years of experience provide you with the knowledge subconsciously?
I will play with text and investigate it in a way that to bend it and to stretch it. And in doing so, I discover these things. I think a lot of stuff happens at this point subconsciously. I'm consciously aware of writing notes or something when I find something new that I'd not been conscious of before. I'll write that note down because I want to remember that I had that moment of light or that epiphany. But otherwise, there's a lot that goes on just in my imagination, just in my in the imagery. I was dyslexic, so I didn't read until I was 11.
Oh my gosh.
Well, once I was able to get out of the idea that it's poetry and that it's a living, breathing piece of words, that it was about painting images, and images on the word, images on the line, images throughout entire passages, then I just glommed onto it. I understood it.
And Nicholas, you are dyslexic. You're not the first actor that we've spoken with who mentions that they were dyslexic and found the theater. What is it about the theater that drew you to it and that helped you overcome some of the challenges that you faced?
I don't think it was necessarily about overcoming. I think it was about expressing myself. I think as a young boy, all that energy that would have gone into reading had no place to go, I think. And so a lot of what I had to work with was the imagery and the emotions that imagery expressed. I had a lot of inner characters and there's a whole silliness I had that was my own. And so the theater, it became very clear to me at a very young age that acting was something I could do. And it wasn't something of attention getting. It was a connection I had to myself that I realized other people did not have. It's all about expressing and connecting and how it was often about imagery and not words.
Isn't it also true that in Shakespeare's day, many of the audience wouldn't have been literate?
Absolutely.
And so the oral tradition was maybe more immediate.
Exactly.
They were used to interacting with the word orally in a way that we are no longer so dependent upon or can enjoy in quite the same way.
I love that. And I guess there's a part of me that wishes that there was someone alive who would really be able to truly capture the spin on a word from 400 years ago.
In this speech, it's so hard not to get such a clear image from the words shrunk, Schenck.
Yes.
If there's a person on this earth who can't get an image from that, I'd be surprised.
Exactly. There was a young girl who was watching the rehearsals for Lear yesterday with her father, and we were sitting, and I was just sort of giving her a rundown of who the characters were, and I was talking just briefly. I just said, and with Shakespeare, it's all about the feeling on the words. So it's not just the words, but it's the feeling that you're going to get when these words land on you. My road to Shakespeare and to verse was not through the words. It was through the sound, the feeling, the imagery. That is what allows me to have access to it in a way that's different.
We recently posted a link on our website that was shared with us by a listener about Shakespeare the Neologist, which is an article about Shakespeare's creation of words, words that had never existed before. There must have been many instances where contemporary audiences of his listening to the plays would have heard his coinages for the very first time.
Yeah.
I don't think that that is an experience which is completely out of our ken as...
No, I'm going to go Google that.
What's that?
I'm going to go Google that. Right?
Yeah, the experience is not out of our ken. Certainly, pop music is full of neologisms.
It is. And, you know, Colbert came up with truthyism, wasn't that it? Or truthiness?
Truthiness. It reminds me of a teacher who once mentioned that the language of Shakespearean English isn't an older language. It's not an antiquated language. Shakespeare was using a language that was 400 years younger than the language we're using now.
So there you go.
I mean, it was hot off the stinking presses.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Just to go back to the speech for a second, there's a lot of repetition in this. There's the and-thens, the thens, and then the very last line, of course, the sans.
Mm-hmm.
As an actor, how do you approach that? Are you aware of it? Do you do anything differently when you have a lot of repetition, particularly that last line?
Dealing with repetition, either in contemporary or classical work, is about understanding who you're talking to as an actor, first of all. So if you have the same word repeated several times, you can't be speaking to the same person each time. You're talking to yourself, God, or the other person, so that you have the intention changes on each one. And with Shakespeare, I always treat them as the new information. For example, that last line there. Again, I sort of look for threes. The number three is a magical number. So I often look for groupings of three or increments of three or how three is reflected in a piece. In this case, it's the sans teeth, sans eye, sans taste. The first line, the sans teeth, it is about the sans the teeth. But after that, it's the realization that it's eyes and taste, and that culminating the three into that last, which is everything. And it's the realization in the moment that it's not just these three hits, it's everything.
And Shakespeare doesn't provide us with any redemption.
Well, I would argue to the contrary. Remember that Jaques delivers this speech, and at the end, there's this grim reminder of mortality, which lands like a ton of bricks on the audience. And then the very next image is of the old man, Adam.
Exactly right.
Being carried onto the stage by the young man, Orlando. An indelible image of love and renewal.
But also of the elderly. He's helping Adam, this old man, on into the space. And when I staged this, it was very much about Jaques sort of seeing this coming in as he's coming to an end. So the end of his piece is being reflected by this character who's coming in. You know, there's a mirroring and a foreshadowing of his own. This is who I will be.
Yes, of course, but just as important as that, there's the image of Adam and his youth and vitality and the message of renewal.
Yes.
That carries.
Well, Nicholas, this has been a delight.
Nicholas Martin Smith, thank you for being our guest on The State of Shakespeare today.
Absolutely. Thank you again.
Thanks, Nicholas.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And this is The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.